Okay, thanks a lot, Shan. Appreciate that. And if Megan's back there somewhere, thanks for the invitation to come and speak to you today. So my goal for the next 30 minutes is to try to keep you entertained. So I know we just had lunch and we're sort of sitting there and starting to get nodded off. So I'm going to try and give you some interesting stuff that I think you might enjoy. So first of all, let me introduce myself to you. I'm an addict and I'm addicted to sequencing things. And just to prove that that's true, there's my current table of things that I've sequenced. 377 individuals representing about 18 different breeds of cattle. There's three bison there, and there's 120 dogs there. And if any of you leave your coffee cups on the table behind you, I might be coming around and swabbing for DNA off your coffee cups. So be careful about that. So total number of nucleotides, DNA bases that we've sequenced to date is this number down there. And that number is 23 gazillion, right? So it's a little difficult for me looking at all those commas to actually figure out where the billions, trillions, and gazillions are. But that is a very big number. So the way you need to think about DNA is that there are 3 billion of them in each of our genomes. And that goes whether or not you're a cow, whether you're a human being, whether you are a dog. We all have about 3 billion DNA bases. And in there are some interesting things. They're the things that make us different. They're the things that make us human. They're the things that make us dogs. They're the things that cause us to grow more efficiently. They're the things that cause us to have different coat colors. They're the things that cause us to have genetic diseases. They're the things that cause us to have differences in fertility. And I'm going to talk about some of that stuff today. So my path down this slippery slope of addiction began about 6 years ago when we were actually studying this problem. This is a Basenji dog, and her name's Miranda. And you'll see a pedigree over there to one side with lots of little black dots in it. Those little black dots represent dead dogs. And Basenjis have a problem with a mutation that causes renal failure. And these poor old dogs get to be about 7 years of age, their kidneys shut down, and they drop dead. And if you look at the pedigree there and do a little bit of analysis, which is what we geneticists do, you can actually figure out it doesn't look as though it's autosomal recessive, but it is. Now, what does that mean? Autosomes. We have humans, right? We have 22 non-sex-related chromosomes. And they're the autosomes. Cows have 29, and then you have the X and the Y chromosomes. They're the ones that determine our gender in most cases, unless you're Jamie Lee Curtis, because she has an X chromosome and a Y chromosome. So I wonder how that is, huh? We can talk about that later. But these poor old Basenjis have got some sort of mutation that segregates, and when you get two copies together, one comes in on mum's chromosome, one comes in on dad's chromosome, they end up getting to be about 7 years old and they die. So we mapped this, and we figured out that it was on chromosome 3, that's this thing down here, and it was in this little region of chromosome 3 that has about 2.7 million DNA bases in it, and we wanted to figure out which one or which ones in there were causing this disease. And it turns out that at the time, and still, that's a very difficult thing to do. But what's not so difficult to do is to sequence the whole darn genome. It's actually relatively easy to just take a DNA sample on an individual, make a library from that, and then put it on an instrument. And the instruments we use are these ones over here. That's the older version of an Illumina instrument. That's the new one. That's my pretty wife right there. And those machines will sequence an entire genome in about 10 days for about $5,000. It's pretty remarkable. $5,000, you get the entire sequence of a genome. And this shows how that's changed in just the last 10 years or so. So back here is when the human genome was sequenced, and the cost of generating the sequence in 2001 to build the human genome sequence assembly was about $100 million. $100 million. Today we do the same thing for $5,000. Boy, life has changed. Now, it's a good time to be doing science, particularly if you're a sequencing addict like I am, right? Because I can sequence just about anything for $5,000. So trick was, I said, let's sequence this dog. Let's sequence this dog and then figure out what is in that sequence that's causing that dog to end up going on and die. And Miranda did die. She went on at 7 years of age. She dropped dead and from this disease. And so we got started on the slippery slope, and it's a very technically demanding slope once you get into it, and it took us about 3 years to figure out how to do it right, how to deal with all of these data. And so when you're dealing with dogs, and I told you we'd sequenced 120 dogs, and we do it by actually collecting blood samples or hair samples. You've got to be a bit careful when you collect hair samples from some of these guys. They don't like it very much when you get a pair of pliers and put it on their tail and rip a handful of hair out. But we've sequenced 120 dogs, and what we do is actually something really very simple. We take Miranda, who has a disease called Fanconi syndrome, and we compare her whole genome sequence to the genome sequences of other dogs that have other diseases, right? Not Fanconi syndrome and also not Basenji's. And we simply say, what's different about those points in the genome? Now, remember, I told you there was 3 billion points in the genome we're comparing. So when you take one dog and you compare it to one other or two others or three others, there are a lot of places where you're going to find differences. But the bottom line is that relatively, if you compare Miranda to 82 other dogs and ask, where is Miranda got two copies of something that I don't find in those other 82 dogs, you're down to 23,000 points in the genome. And that's from 3 billion. That's pretty remarkable. If you further restrict that to just the regions in the genome that are genes and make proteins, you're down to 87. And if you're a smart person like Gary Johnson, who I work with, who's a biochemist, he can look at those 87 genes and look down the list and says, that's probably that one right there. And then we go ahead and test that in some more Basenjis, and we find the mutation that causes the disease. If you sequence two of these affected animals and compare them to just 32, you're down to only 2,000 places in the genome, or 11 within genes that are potentially candidates for causing that disease. What this means is that if you are concerned about genetic defects, are there any people in this room that are registered breeders and are concerned about genetic defects within their breed? Yeah, there's a few of you in there, right? What this means is from the point that you detect a genetic defect, that is, you find a calf and there's something wrong with it, and the veterinarian comes along and says, ooh, I think this is genetic. We can sequence those animals, and within a month we'll know what the mutation is. We'll know what the broken gene is that causes that defect, and we can have a test for it, and we can apply it to the population as a whole. That's how fast this technology works. Okay. This also ignores something that's kind of important. It ignores the fact that all of these things, including the defects we see in cattle, turn up because the animals are inbred. The animals are a little bit inbred. And what that means is that they have two copies of a little piece of DNA that are identical by descent. And you can see that in the variants, in the sequence of these individuals. So what these figures show here is, it's not particularly obvious, but as you go along chromosome 28 in this dog, I'm looking at bins and I'm saying, does this animal have, at all of the points that are variable along that piece of chromosome, does it have, is it homozygous, heterozygous? And I just average that for a bin of about 1,000 bases. And I just say, yeah, this guy's got lots and lots of variability up here. And I get to this point on the chromosome, and all that variability disappears. What that means is it has two little pieces of chromosome that originated in the ancestor that this disease mutation occurred in, right? So if you're looking at predestined, right, and the mutation that originated in that animal that caused, what was that, CA, right? That was CA in the Angus breed. Every calf that has CA has two little pieces of DNA that came from predestined that actually caused that genetic defect. And when we do that, when we actually filter the 3 billion nucleotides, we can collapse the genome down to about 10% of the genome and just say, all right, in these little regions of the genome where I see inbreeding, two copies of the same chromosome, what are the mutations there that could possibly cause this disease? So it's powerful, and this is how powerful it is. In the last year or so, we found about 8 different mutations in all these different breeds of dogs that cause all kinds of different diseases. They're mostly neurological diseases. The group that I work with is interested in seizure disorders and ataxias and things like that. And the reason we're interested in dogs is we use these dogs as models for human disease. We actually treat these dogs that are affected. Once we know the gene that's broken, We can actually replace the enzyme in the brain of these dogs by putting a little shunt into the brain and a little pump in the shoulder of these dogs, and it pumps enzyme into their brain, and we can cure these diseases. Once we know the gene that's broken, the enzyme that's not being produced. So if you're going to do something like this, you need to sequence your own dogs, of course, because it's cool. And I have two dogs. I sequenced this dog down here because he actually was born with a cardiac problem. And the problem with him is that he has the same granddaddy on both sides of his pedigree. So he's 12.5% inbred. The breeder that bred him thought that was a good thing to do because they wanted to fix the good traits in that granddaddy. Bad luck when you do that. You also fix the bad traits that were present within the granddaddy. In this case, he's got a heart murmur. Little difficult for me to find it because 12.5% of his genome has those flat spots in it, right, where he's identical by descent, and it's a little hard to filter through all of the millions of bases and genes in there and try to figure out what the mutation is. This guy, on the other hand, up here, seems to always be sneaking my beer bottles and drinking beer on me, and so I argued to my lab that we ought to sequence him because I think he's got a drinking problem, and they turned around and said, look, I think it's probably environmental. But that's all right. I'm going to sequence him anyway, okay? He's my dog. I get to do these things. So what about in cows? I showed you that we've sequenced 254 cows. Well, they're actually bulls. They represent about 18 different breeds, and we've actually analyzed data on about 197 of them at this point. You can imagine this is a lot of data and a lot of work to get through. But what this shows you is all of the variation in the genome that affects genes. So there are 137,000 points in the genome where an amino acid gets changed, and so it changes the protein that gets produced by that amino acid. There are 11,000 points in the genome where there are broken genes. These are mutations that get in there and just break a gene. Crazy, that's a large amount. When I saw that, I thought, man, that is ridiculously large. If you come further down here, what you'll see is that right here, this is the column that says, did we find any bulls that had two copies of those mutations? And in fact, it says that of the 10,000 broken genes, there are actually bulls that have 6,000 of them in homozygous form, two copies. These are bulls like EXT, and these are important bulls that are running around. There's nothing wrong with them. You look at them, they're pretty handsome-looking bulls. They're good performance bulls. So these genes are not killing the animals. They're not causing genetic defects, but they cause a problem. They cause a problem in that the animal has to figure out how to live without an enzyme. It has to use a backup system. So there is a cost to having these. It may not be a cost as big as having a genetic defect. It may not be a cost as big as being dead, but there is a cost to having these. On the other hand, the ones that there are real costs to are the ones that are down here. These are the ones that we never saw in animals that had two copies. So there are 347 mutations in genes that cause them to lose function. And they are in genes that we know are essential for life. How do we know that? Because we know if we knock them out in mice, the mice can't live. The mice are dead. You knock it out in a mouse, the mouse is dead. You knock it out in a zebrafish, the zebrafish is dead. You knock it out in humans in some cases, and we know that the animal's dead. So we found in cattle, 197 cattle, 347 mutations that look as though they're lethals. What does that mean? It means they impact fertility in your breeds. It means that these things are not lethals when the calves hit the ground, but they're lethal because the embryo doesn't develop. The embryo doesn't implant. The embryo doesn't produce a calf. Okay, and some of these things here, 2,102 mutations that change amino acids, some of those are going to be lethals too. Okay, so we actually went back and said, well, what does this mean for the Angus breed? We did it in Angus because we have 99 of them sequenced now. And the range is this, that there are 86 bulls represented here, and these 86 bulls have heifer pregnancy EPDs. And these 86 bulls vary between carrying 5 lethals and 23 lethals each, and the average is about 12. So this is the average Angus bull. Carries 12 lethals.
And what is the effect of carrying? And this shows you, these are the bulls down here that carry the most. There's one bull up here that has 23. There's two here that are about 19, etc. And I've just got them ranked. Here are the bulls down here. And I've just got them ranked by the number that they carry. So there are some bulls that don't carry very many. I bet you these are more highly fertile bulls than these guys up here. But what else is important is the frequency at which these things occur in the population. If I carry a lethal that nobody else in the population carries, I'm never going to be able to produce a dead calf, right? Because the allele that comes from all the females that, not I, but a bull would be bred to, would never end up with that lethal in homozygous form. So really rare lethals don't matter very much. It's the ones that are in high frequency that matters. And so what we've done here is actually summed up the frequency. So for the 13 lethal loci that these bulls here carry, we sum up the frequency that they appear in the population, and that, in fact, gives us a molecular breeding value for fertility on these bulls. And that's what these little red circles are, and what you see is that these red circles vary a lot. And in particular, if you take a look at, there's two bulls right here that carry 19 of these things. One of them has a little red circle up there, one of them has a little red circle up there. They're about 50% different for the impact that those alleles have on the expected fertility of bulls. Why? Because one of those bulls carries a whole bunch of things that are rare in the population, and the other bull carries a whole bunch of things that are common in the population. And so, do these things matter? Do these things have any impact at all on fertility? Well, we did a little bit of an analysis where we actually regressed those values, the molecular breeding values that I told you we calculated on heifer pregnancy EPD, and even though it doesn't look great, that line there has a negative slope. And what it means is we are actually able to predict heifer pregnancy from these alleles in the bulls. There's a couple of problems with this analysis that we're currently working on. One is we don't have a real good estimate of what the frequencies of these alleles are in the population. Secondly, a bull's daughters only get half the alleles that he carries. So the pregnancy of heifers out of a bull is affected only by half that are transmitted from the bull. But it looks like we're on the right path. It looks like we are actually identifying loci from sequencing these things that are directly impacting the fertility of bulls due to early embryonic loss. Okay, so what do we think the overall impact of this is on the population? Again, we don't have good figures on this, but what I've done here is I just did a back of the envelope calculation where I said, let's suppose that this is the number of lethals that we find, and this is the frequency of each of those lethals in the population, then this represents the proportion of pregnancies that you lose. The proportion of pregnancies that are going to be lost just because these things are segregating through the population, being transmitted from bulls and cows to their progeny. And I think we're down here. The red figures correspond to the situation where every individual, on average, carries 10 of these things. And in this case, in Angus, we know that that's pretty close. Each bull carries about 10 of these things. And so I think we're actually somewhere down about here. I think that between 5 and 10% of all pregnancies that occur get lost simply because the embryo is homozygous for something that is lethal and is taking those out. And that is why you have 90-day breeding seasons, right? That is why you have 90-day breeding seasons. You lose the first embryo, you come back, you have another shot at it. And that is why you have calving seasons that Allison showed you that are spread right out. If we could get rid of these things and have not 5 to 10% of pregnancies occurring earlier on in the calving season, you'd pull that spread right back. You'd have heavier heifers when you're going back into replacement, and the whole thing, the whole deal. Okay, so how do we prove this? I mean, right now, this is all computer work, right? I don't have any data on animals other than the animals that we've sequenced. So there's two things we can do, and this is one of the things that we're doing in the grant, and Allison's a part of this grant. Dave Patterson back there is the PI on this grant. He's leading the work. That means he gets to go out and collect 10,000 heifers for us so that we can actually genotype these heifers. So what we can do is we can take all the stuff we found in sequencing and we can build a genotyping assay. That's a genotyping assay right up there. Okay, that's the 50K assay that some of you may know. My group was part of the two or three groups in the world that built that thing. We can build another one of those, but we can put 200,000 of these variants that we find in the sequencing experiment on that chip, and then we can go collect 10,000, in this case, Angus heifers. We can genotype those heifers, and we can ask the question, which one of these never turn up in two copies in an animal? And if they never turn up in two copies, there's one reason for it. That's because if you get two copies, you're not a live animal, and we could never pull a tail sample out of you. And it will unequivocally tell us which ones of these are lethal and cause fertility reductions in animals. This experiment's going to cost $400,000. We've got the money to do that in the grant. We've got the sequencing done. We've got the variants identified. We're going to build the assay next year and we'll apply that to this population of primarily Angus heifers that we've collected throughout Missouri, a little bit into Iowa, I believe. There's another approach that just occurred to me fairly recently, and it's based upon something I'll share with you in a minute, the idea that led to this, and it's called imputation. And what I really mean by that is I've got a bull, this is EXT, and EXT has been genotyped here for the 50K chip. And the way to think about that is that if we drew a straight line between New York City and Los Angeles, right, and then the markers that we have on that 50K chip, these markers right here, would be spread out about every 250 feet. We would have a marker that we use right now for genomic selection, genomic enhanced EPDs, right? Within all of the breeds are doing this stuff. Well, what if I could use that information and the fact that I've sequenced 99 bulls, including EXT's father and his mother's father, so the maternal grandsire, as well as his sire, can I estimate what his whole genome sequence is based upon my knowledge of the 50K? And that would be like saying I'm going to go from having one marker every 250 feet between New York and Los Angeles to having one marker every 16th of an inch between New York and Los Angeles. That's the actual density with which we're going. We're going from a 50K chip to the whole genome sequence in that individual. Can we actually get away with doing that? Turns out we can. We've tried this in an Angus population. We took two regions on chromosome 7 and on chromosome 20, and we used pedigree information and the 94 individuals at that point that we'd actually sequenced. That's what the pedigree looks like. Goes back to animals born in the 50s and 60s. And we tried to estimate their whole genome sequence. And it turned out we could do it with about 90% accuracy, which is actually pretty remarkable. And the accuracy depends upon how well related the animals that you're estimating their genotypes are to the animals that you've sequenced. Well, the animals that we've sequenced in all breeds are the ones that have the greatest impact on the breed. They have the greatest number of registrations, the greatest number of sons that have registrations and the like. And that's why it actually works pretty well, because the animals that we've sequenced are the really, really important animals within each of the breeds. The EXTs, you know, and a lot of others that we've sequenced within the different breeds. So the question now is, how much 50K data is floating around out there? I don't know if you know this. I started doing a little survey a couple of days ago with some of the breed associations and talking to them about whether or not they'd be prepared to share that with us. Angus now has between 60 and 70,000 individuals that have been genotyped with the 50K chip. Scimitar's up around 24,000 animals. Hereford's over 6,000. Red Angus is at 3,800. Limousine about 3,400. Charolais about 1,200. These numbers are actually getting up to be quite dramatic. And if we could get these samples from the breed associations and take the 50K data and estimate that up to whole genome sequence In Angus, we can almost get to 60,000 individuals that we've got full genome sequence on. And now I can go through those animals and say which ones of these points in the DNA never turn up in two copies. And with 60,000 individuals, I guarantee you, we'll identify the lethals in that genome. Now, there's two things that are important about that. Well, there are three things that are important about that. Number one is that Angus has agreed to do this, and they're getting me the DNA samples. I just talked to these guys, and they're about to also provide us, I believe, with these genotype samples so that we can do it in the other breeds. So the breed associations are pumped about this. I'm pumped about this. I think it's really exciting. Secondly, it's free. We don't have to spend more money to genotype animals. I can take animals that have already been genotyped with the 50K chip, and I can run through, I can identify the lethals that impact fertility in each of those animals, and then return that information to the breed associations. So the breed associations will know the carriers, the animals that carry broken genes that cause their embryos produced with those to fail and not result in a calf. And I can provide that back for free too. That's all. It all costs nothing. It just costs time and energy. So that's pretty exciting, but it has a downside. Downside is life's starting to get more complicated for you guys, isn't it? You know, it's not so bad when you're dealing with DD and CA, but what happens when you have to start dealing with 350 mutations that cause embryonic loss? How the hell do you do that? Well, the way to do that is using mate selection software. And I think Allison's going to talk exactly about that. You don't have to do it. We need to build computer software that can be driven through the breed association servers. All you've got to do is get onto the website, say, here are my cows, here are the bulls I want to use. Do you have them genotyped for these loss of function mutations? And now instead of saying, these are the 10 bulls you need to use in your breeding program, it'll say, these are the 10 bulls you need to use in your breeding program, but oh, by the way, breed this bull to this cow, this bull to that cow, and when you do that, we expect your overall pregnancy rates to increase by 2 or 3% because you are avoiding breeding bulls to cows that carry the same loss of function alleles. So, the other thing you can do, which is actually pretty cool, is start running after some of these really large effect genes. There are two genes that we know in Angus. These are also in Herefords and Simmentals that have really big effects on growth. This is birth weight. And what this shows is the position on a chromosome, and this shows the magnitude of the effect. And what you see is this big spike right here. It's a gene on that piece of the chromosome that has a really big effect on growth. It has an effect. These are all 17 traits that are recorded by the Angus Association. It has a really big effect on all 17 of the traits that are recorded by the Angus Association. It also impacts feed intake and feed efficiency. We know that from other work that we've done. We can run after these things, and the way we do that is we impute sequence data into our mapping populations, and then we come back and we analyze sequence data. So this is a region of chromosome 7 where we have imputed about 5,000 sequence variants into 3,500 Angus bulls, and we go through sequentially and test them and say, which is the one that causes the effect? Oh, it's that one there. This is an interesting point because when I do the same thing for marbling and milk, I get signals at slightly different points on the chromosome. It's not the same variant that causes the effect on growth as has an impact on marbling and milk. And in fact, none of those things happen to be in genes. But they happen to be right next to a gene called arrestin-3, which is a major regulator of growth. So we can actually now, I think, for the very first time, start trying to think about picking off these large effect mutations. And if we can do that and put these on genotyping chips, we can increase the accuracy of genomic enhanced DPDs. I'm going to finish up right quick talking about this. The last thing you can do with sequence data is go look for things like this. So this is a Hereford. It's got a spotted face. All Herefords have that spotted face, and you know it's dominant. And about 15 years ago, Mike Gross mapped it. I'm going the wrong way, sorry. Mike Gross and Mike McNeil mapped it to chromosome 6, really close to this gene called KIT right here. which is tyrosine kinase. And we know that that gene has an effect on coat color in lots and lots of breeds of cattle. Nobody's found the mutation that causes those animals to have spots on their face. We actually studied our sequence data and came up with a region of the chromosome where every single Hereford out of 800 are identical. They have exactly the same piece of DNA on mum's chromosome and dad's chromosome in every single Hereford in the world. And that is consistent with every single Hereford in the world having white face. So we actually sequenced, we actually took our sequence data for that particular region, and we started to look and say, what is different about Herefords to other animals that don't have white faces? And it turns out there's nothing in the sequence variation. It's not a point mutation that changes a gene. It's something else. What we found is, this is looking at basically 14 Herefords that we'd sequenced, and this is looking at 10 Angus that we'd sequenced. This is the region that Kit is in, and this shows you the depth of sequence coverage. And what it shows you is that there is something repeated right here and right here within Angus animals. It's a repetitive element within the sequence. It's present over here also in Herefords, but look, Herefords have got it all filled in. There's something duplicated in the sequence of Herefords here and here upstream that's not present there. Just to prove that that's true, there's the 10 Angus bulls that we sequenced. There's the 14 Herefords. They all have it. They all have a really different pattern that represents different copy number of the DNA. Be right with you. So we figured that it's impacting the way Kit is being expressed. And the question is, which one was it? Is it the one that's downstream? Well, here's a bunch of Indocene cattle and bison. They all have this thing downstream, but only this guy here has a white face. None of these rest of these guys have white faces. So it's not that. It's got to be the one that's upstream. And Simmentals have it. No surprise. Actually, what this means is Herefords originated from Simmentals. So any Hereford breeders in the room? If you're a Hereford breeder, your Herefords came from Europe about 2,000 to 3,000 years ago as Simmentals. They got into England, they started breeding with other cattle that were in England, and they turned into Herefords, right? And in that process, they selected for this really nice face pattern and retained the little bit of the genome that originated right there in Simmental cattle. And that's why they have white faces. So you can answer all of these things. And this just proves it by looking at some Beefmasters. We sequenced 10 Beefmasters. Here's the sequence. And these are the pictures of the Beefmasters that we sequenced. One animal down here with a white face, guess what? He's got that right there. So that's it. That is the variant that causes white face color in Beefmaster cattle. This is my favorite picture from Oklahoma, by the way. If you look at that license plate right there, I whited out the actual number, but that's an Oklahoma plate right there. So appreciate your attention. Thanks for your time.